This is the legislative session for 2026 FCB 73rd anniversary. Our host this evening, or this afternoon, is Travis Butler. It feels like it's nighttime. Our streamer is Jane Suh. Our in-house Zoom individual is Mr. Ryan Cordell. We want to thank ACB Media. We have, and Cecily Nipper is our monitor. So now I will turn this over to the Chair of Governmental Affairs, Ms. Debbie Grubb.
Greetings, everybody. I want to thank you for coming, and I have a few words to share with you in an attempt to introduce what we're trying to do today. Number one, this is going to be my last time before you as Chair of Governmental Affairs.
No.
Thank you, that's very kind. I want to tell you why. Nobody's mad, nobody's done anything, but what I want to tell you is that I feel like I have done a pretty good job in making lots of appointments over the years. We have had meaningful support for our initiatives from Florida. But it would not have been possible if we hadn't had the wonderful people going to DC, keeping those appointments, and talking up to people with passion and knowledge about our events. And so of that, I am very proud. The thing I did not do well is get people more interested in calling, writing, getting involved. I didn't get you all to catch the glow of whether you voted for these people or not, of being able to talk to them, to send them an email, to talk to their legislative assistants. So, in my last year, we have tried an experiment, which we're going to talk to you about in just a few minutes, just a couple minutes. And the point of the experiment was to see how can we work to get more people involved, to get a better representation of our beautiful state of Florida, instead of the same few people going to DC every year. So we tried a Zoom option this year, and I'm gonna give in a moment our wonderful team leaders that I invited to do this for the first time. They made the appointments, they set up the meetings, they moderated their meetings, and you're going to meet them all in just one moment here.
Could somebody turn off the podium mic?
So, the point is,
thank you
so much. So the point is that we have learned some things from this experiment. What I also want to say to you is some people misunderstood the point of the experiment. We always knew that in-person visits were best. But with this experiment, we wanted very much to try to get more people to feel comfortable in making appointments, in setting things up, and more people talking about it. So the new chair will have some very interesting information to build the next phase of our legislative presence, both in the state of Florida and in our congressional delegation in DC. So I personally want to thank each of you for being so kind to me for the far too many years I served as chair of this committee, and I thank you for your kindness. And now I'm going to introduce to you one at a time the team leaders. I chose these people, I asked people if they wanted to, but I chose people who had a variety of personalities, a variety of life experiences, and a variety of experience with working with leadership in the legislative congressional forum. So the first person that is going to talk to you is a lovely lady who I hope will remain involved in our Zoom efforts because she cannot walk the halls of DC. But her name is Peggy Carpenter. Many of you know her through the auctions, and she did a phenomenal job with her group, and I want her to speak with you first.
Okay, Sheila, can you hand the mic?
All right, thanks. Thank you. Thank you all very much. As Debbie pointed out, I've really wanted to get involved with this effort, but I have a bad ankle, so I can't really do all that walking. But I've always enjoyed this kind of thing. So when Debbie was looking for volunteers, I said, count me in. So I really enjoyed it. We had we only had four calls that we were assigned, and I was surprised that I was fairly easily able to get appointments. Now, of course, two of them had to be rescheduled a couple times. You know, things come up for these legislative assistants, and I think it's important to be aware of that. And I think the virtual effort in doing that was useful in those situations because it was much easier to reschedule, you know, sometimes even a week later. And if you're in town, obviously that's not something you want to be able to do. So I think that's one effort. It was much more flexible with the virtual, and we were able to kind of adjust pretty quickly. I also involved a couple of people on my team that had not ever been involved before, and I think they both really enjoyed it. And I think that it was, you know, as Debbie said, you have to leave the whole thing about, like, who you voted for or whatever at the door. And, you know, I was kind of surprised to find that of my people, three were in one party, one was in the other. And the one was the party I had voted for and thought, oh, they'll be the most interested. And the legislative assistant we got for that one was not very engaged. So you really have to leave your politics at the door and just talk to the person one-on-one, and you'll find that they really do get engaged. Thanks.
Thank you, Peggy. Thank you very much. Sure. Great. Now, another sweet person who's done some work with us at Tallahassee Day, and you know from Project Insight and so many things, Mary Kay, is Nancy Folsom. I'm going to have her talk to you now.
Thank you. I actually got two appointments scheduled. Well, three, one of them ditched me, but that's what you deal with even in, when you're there in person, I'm sure. And I really... I was excited. I got my team members involved in presenting the imperatives, and they were excited to do it. And I'm sorry, I don't know why it's squealing.
Go ahead.
Okay. So they were very excited to be able to, you know, each of them kind of took an imperative and became very familiar with it. And so their presentation was very informative to the LAs, and the ones that I had were extremely involved and very interested. They wanted more information, kept asking very good questions, and I felt it was really a great experience. They just kept saying, you know, let us know if there's anything else we can do, and we really are interested in this, and we can't believe that these imperatives haven't already been put into law. So it was really a very good learning experience. I'm glad I had the Tallahassee Day as kind of a background, but this was completely different because you're dealing with, you know, people on the national level. But I encourage you to try to reach out and get involved, because if we don't do anything, nothing's going to get done. And yes, we may not make a difference, but most likely we will. So I hope you'll get involved. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, an advocate that you really need to get to know is Marsha Bukala, and I'm so grateful to Sheila for introducing her to us and to all of FCB. And Marsha is going to share some of her experiences with you, but the other thing I've asked her to talk about is an initiative that ACB has brought forward for all of us, and it's called Speak For.
As your host, I need to interrupt and say that Anna Eskamali has joined.
Okay. Tell, thank you so much. Well, what we'll do is let's do this, and then we will stop this and let Anna. But I want her to talk to about Speak For as a little preview before Anna speaks. So Anna is next, and we will introduce her with great pride. But if you could just talk a little bit about what you did, and then the Speak For, and why it's so important, and then we'll have Anna.
Okay. All righty. So I had five U.S. Congress districts, and we had three meetings and one to still come. I'd love to know if anyone in this room lives in Gus Bilirakis's district, because he was hiring a new legislative aide. I also had one District 3 decline to meet with us because of the imperatives being the same thing. So one thing I learned, I think it's really important that even when we request these meetings, one of our members who lives in the district, we have their name in the email. And then I know a lot of people, I was kind of surprised, and I did have two new people join my group who had never done this type of call, and people don't know who their House reps are, and there's a really easy way to do that. The Speak For platform, all you have to do is put your address in, it's going to pop up who it is, and automatically send the message to them. And I had some numbers pulled, and as of May 8th, and there's been many Speak For campaigns for about a year now, 127 people have sent messages to their representatives. And then I also have numbers. I'm not going to go into this now, but I can pull by district the different legislative asks that we had or something we don't want them to support, which we may have recently seen, which is really, really important. So I would really ask that people even watch about the Speak For community call and look into that, or you can go to house.gov to look up who your legislative reps are, and make sure you're registered to vote. Thank you.
Okay, we are going. Okay, we are going to hear from our other wonderful team leaders in just a moment, but thanks again to Sheila for introducing to us several years ago Representative Anna Eskamani. And I was getting it. she has been so wonderful with giving advice, with coming and speaking to many of our legislative seminars on a multitude of subjects. And she is terming out this year, and we are going to miss her more than we can begin to say. And I wanted Anna to come, and in this moment of bittersweetness, because she's accomplished so much and she means so much to so many, especially to us, to give us her view about how we can best work with our legislators, even the ones for whom we did not vote, and what that means and how we can get ourselves involved on all levels. And because she is so eloquent, I'm going to let her talk, but please listen to what she has to say, because I've never heard Anna give anything but good advice. So thank you. It's all yours, Anna.
Oh, that is the kindest and sweetest introduction I've ever had. Thank you so much. That means the world to me. And it's great to be with everyone. I'm so sorry that I cannot physically be with you. I was so looking forward to it. I had on my calendar for months. Thank you, Sheila, for making sure that I was always going to be there. But as you probably know, we got called back to Tallahassee for a special session on the budget. And I'm actually in the car on the way home right now. So hopefully the connection will stay strong. But again, I'm so grateful that I could be here. And it is my last term, so it's super bittersweet. But I've learned so much. And I'm excited to give y'all a quick update on what's happening with the budget, but also, as was mentioned, share some advice and guidance on being an effective advocate, especially with your state government, but with all levels of government. And though I am termed out this November, I am running to be the next mayor of Orlando in 2027. Thank you so much. And I will continue to bring this passion and commitment and, of course, inclusivity to the city. I want to make sure the city is the friendliest and most accessible in the world. And we're very, very committed to going beyond the bare minimum to make that happen, going beyond the standards of the ADA to ensure that every person can truly, truly be independent and contribute as their wholehearted selves. And so with that said, I was first elected back in 2018, for those that remember, and we've served with grit and grace now for 8 years. Now, I'm a member of the Minority Caucus, which means we are 30-some strong. Like right now, I think there's 34 Democrats out of a body of 120. So it's a pretty uneven dynamic where we don't have the numbers to set the agenda. We also don't have the numbers to even stop bills. And it's obviously frustrating because you see these policies get pushed through and you want to be able to do something. But oftentimes our tools are very limited to asking tough questions, to filing lawsuits, to amending legislation. But we do pursue all those avenues. And in fact, today there is a Supreme Court hearing on emergency injunction on the partisan gerrymander maps, which we voted no on. And we also worked with our legal teams to ask questions to help build a basically a foundation for lawsuits. So hopefully we'll hear next week what that decision is. But I share that example because, you know, you have to be willing to advocate for your community, even when the numbers are not in your favor, even when the outlook does not seem bright. See, approach that is required to not only protect our civil liberties as much as possible, but to hopefully inspire others to want to get more civically engaged and to help shift the trajectory in the future. Because apathy is why we have the situation today. It's so important for every person to realize that they have an opportunity to engage with their local governments, and that local government will only work if you are at that table. And so some quick pieces of advice, and I want to open up for questions to hear what's top of mind for you too. When I am able to pass legislation, and by the way, as you might know, we've championed many issues that impact every type of Floridian. You know, I've championed affordability issues on housing and tenant protections. I focus on environmental policy to protect our water and our air, to hold big corporate actors, big corporate polluters accountable. I've done work in the tax silo. I'm the Ways and Means ranking member. So I'm an expert on taxation, and I try really hard to give tax breaks to consumers while closing corporate tax loopholes. But I also do a lot of work in the disability silo, and I've been really honored to work with organizations like Disability Rights Florida, organizations that have centered their focus and they're led by and led for people with disabilities. And that has led to our success with policies like Right to Repair, for mobility devices, which has passed the House, fortunately not the Senate, so we have to try again. Another member will have to try again next year. Elopement prevention for children with autism. And most recently, our drowning prevention legislation, which did get signed into law. And this is going to be really important policy that expands the criteria to access Florida's free swim lessons program and ensures that new parents have information about the risks of drowning and how to prevent drowning. And so working in that silo has offered me opportunities to find common ground across the aisle, because what I have found is that if you're willing to be respectful but firm in your values, and you're willing to do your research so you're informed and know what you're talking about, that you can identify relationships despite the odds. Despite fighting like cats and dogs on some issues, there is an opportunity to work in tandem towards shared goals. And it actually reminds me of grace. I think that a lot of times we have to practice grace for ourselves and even grace for others when trying to find those opportunities for common ground. And for me, that also looks like the art of persuasion and being willing to give space for someone to process information, sometimes on their own timeline, which is not my timeline, but I have to give folks space to process, to understand why their viewpoint is incorrect and why they should evolve on that position. And in these 8 years, I have seen only my own constituents evolve over time on different positions, but also my colleagues as well. And of course, this session has been marked with a lot of tension. You've probably read in the news tension around immigration and the so-called Alger Alcatraz and its imminent closure. You've probably heard tension between Governor Ron DeSantis and the Speaker of the House in the chamber that I serve. And that's one reason why we don't have a state budget yet. But it reminds all of us, right, that just because people are in the same party does not mean they get along. And that's an opportunity for us to leverage, because when you are witnessing any type of tension, it's an opportunity to try to be that bridge builder, right? Trying to figure out, okay, how do we get to consensus? How do we solve this problem? And in my case, you know, my focus is the Florida House of how do we reach consensus in the Florida House? But it's important to never make assumptions of where someone is coming from, regardless of the party next to their name. And so I think that's an important lesson for me in this process, is to find opportunities for common ground, but to also be willing to call people out when you've already called them in, because you never want to be soft on your values or sacrifice your values. And so it's important to call people in before you call them out, but to also not be afraid to engage in that more large-scale advocacy, whether it's the letter writing or phone calling or email blasting or town hall, you know, approaching town halls and asking tough questions there. You want to be able to map that out strategically, but I do think it's important to get to know your lawmakers first before you make those assumptions. And you know, the election cycle this November, as y'all probably know, every state house seat is up for re-election. So we're going to have 45 some new freshman lawmakers who chances are not experts in the issues. And so my last piece of advice is to reach out to those freshman lawmakers, request a meeting, educate them on your life experience, on the policy that you care about, and continue to build that relationship, because I do think that there are more opportunities for common ground than you would think. But it all starts with that initial conversation. And at the end of the day, you are the experts, not us. We're the facilitators, but you are the experts. And so really appreciate everyone here who's been that expert for me these past 8 years, that have guided me through policy debates and prioritization. And again, I look so forward to continuing our work together, regardless of what title I have or don't have next to my name. I consider each one of you to be incredible friends and leaders, and I'm just so excited to see what the future holds for each one of us. And so thank you again. I'm happy to take any questions if folks have them.
Do we have somebody to run a mic? We'll take three questions.
This is Paul Edwards, and I wonder if you could just give us a 30-second or 1-minute notion of where the budget is.
I would love to. Thank you so much, Paul, for that question. I might need more than 30 seconds, though. Okay, so the budget. My goodness. So as a reminder for my friends that are my friends with me today, the state constitution has one responsibility for the legislature, and that is to pass a balanced budget, which did not happen. We left regular session in March. March 13th was the last day of regular session, and we don't have a budget yet. And our fiscal year goes to effect July 1st. So you can imagine that if you are a public school teacher or a state employee at a state agency, maybe you work at the agency for a person with disabilities. Maybe you're a nonprofit that receives a contract that does services for the state of Florida. The uncertainty for all these different stakeholders is real. And so a budget has to happen no later than June 30th. We also have a constitutional responsibility of what's called the cooling down period, which means that whenever the budget is given to us, the final budget is shared with the public, we have to wait 3 days before we can vote on it. And so we have to put in that timeline, right, into our cushion as well, a 3-day cushion, basically, for a budget to land on our desks, but then for us to review it and then vote on it. And then the governor has a veto authority where he can basically look through the budget and do what are called line item vetoes. So as we gather here today, conferencing is pretty much wrapped up. There will be a few more what are called conference meetings later today. For those who don't know what a conference meeting is, basically it's when House and Senate members come together to kind of duke it out. So we have our draft budget on the House, they have their draft budget in the Senate. So there's spending priorities that are a little bit different for both chambers based on leadership, interest, and so forth. And so we get together and we try to match where we can match on our budget items. And then issues that are unresolved get bumped. That's another term that we use called bumped. Things get bumped to the chair, so the appropriation chairs. And in that situation, there really is not a lot of transparency at all. But with that context provided, conferencing will end today at around 3 o'clock. And then it will just be the chairs. They're going to work on the budget, basically the two of them and with their staff. And we are, at this point, hopeful to vote on the final budget the week of Memorial Day. So the week of May 27th. So I'm very hopeful that we will have a budget for the people of Florida before May is over. And then it has to go to the governor for that line item veto. So that's where we are right now. I will tell you that there are still a lot of unresolved line items, including the iBudget waiver. There's no indication of how much money it's going to receive at this time. Things like affordable housing programs, arts and culture funding, even public school funding and educational enhancement dollars, all of that has not been confirmed yet. And so we'll be continuing to advocate on these issues and more, but that's pretty much where we're at this time.
Another question? Okay. Anna, thank you from our hearts. And that was an eloquent answer to the budget question. My gosh, that should go in a textbook. Thank you so much. And thank you for coming. And God bless you. And I don't live here, but if I did, I'd vote for you as mayor in a heartbeat.
So sweet. Oh, so kind.
Okay, now we're gonna continue with our wonderful team leaders. What I want to say before we call on the next one is, again, I want you to understand, I sent them a process paper that told them what I did. I sent them a sample letter. We had several meetings. I gave them all of the Florida congressional delegation. We parsed them out to all of these leaders. And some of them called me, and I did my best, but they all did a phenomenal job. And so what I also want to say is that we're not giving up Zoom, and we're not giving up in person. And when these have spoken, I'll talk to you just a minute more, and then we're going to move to the second portion of our program. So I would like to call on Paul Lewis now as a team leader to say a couple words to us.
Again, I'm Paul Lewis. I was not as fortunate as my co-chairs or co-captains, and I had five representatives to schedule meetings with, and I was only able to schedule one, and that was my representative, Byron Donalds. Captain of the group, I take full responsibility for not doing a more effective job, and these things happen. I don't know if the fact that when we were reaching out to them that we did not have anyone from their districts, that they decided not to schedule the meetings. There were multiple attempts to reach out to them and to schedule meetings, but it is what it is, and sometimes things fall the wrong way. But I am definitely committed to advocacy and legislation, and will remain with this committee and working forward and doing all that I can for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. I just want to say that we do not have the funds to send someone from every district to DC. And what I do, and what our team leaders will probably do likewise or something similar, I just tell them, we have people all over the state. We have not the money to send a constituent to every office. Do you want us to report to your member that you would not see us, although we have constituents in our organization. So, but you know what? I commend Paul's honesty, and I would say that this is a learning experience. It was an experiment, and we all had something to learn. And so I'm going to now ask Sheila, who was also a team leader, and have her talk to you about her very positive experience.
Good afternoon. My team did really well. I was very happy with my team. We were able to meet with all of them that we were assigned. We had wonderful engagement. I think there was one that was so-so, but the rest of them were extremely engaged, talkative, communicative, wanted more information when the bills came out, wanted the numbers, wanted to just know as much as they could know. So I agree with Debbie, this was an experiment. I don't think, in my opinion, and this is strictly my opinion, I don't think we involved a whole lot of other people this year that we would not have been able to send, which really breaks my heart, because we've got over 700 members in FCB. And if we can't get people to care about some of these imperatives, then how can we? How can we get you involved? How can we make you concerned about what is important to us as blind and low vision? So I think that's something that every member should think about and really consider. How can we get you involved? How would it impress you or improve your life if these imperatives pass or if they don't pass? You know, how will it affect you is what I think you need to really think about. So thank you for letting me take part in it.
You're so welcome. We got everybody, right? Good. Okay. Yes. Oh, hi. You know, you weren't up here and I kind of think, could you please get Miss Mary, Mike, and if you'd been up here.
I know.
Anyway,
we're
happy.
I apologize. I thought it started at 1:30, so I got here about 20 after, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they started without me. Anyway, I apologize for that. But I would like to say that I love being involved in this. This is like one of my favorite things. And this year was really new for me because I've never been a leader of anything except. Well, I'm not even the leader in my house. My animals rule that. So anyway, but I was a little hesitant, but I've said, you know what? I'm going to do my best. So we met with four of the five, one we just simply could not connect with. They wanted times and dates, and we just couldn't make it happen. One in particular I was very excited about, he came to our meeting late. We had set it up, and he came late, and in the midst of all this, I was learning how to set up Zoom meetings, and this was really quite interesting. But he came to the meeting late, and he apologized, and he was very interested, and he wanted. And so we actually met with him again. He wanted to meet again so he could hear more details. I appreciate my team so much. I got to work with Cassandra, who you all know, and with Ricardo Salazar, who I didn't know. Yay! And Ricardo was amazing, and I was so pleased to get to work with him. And I felt like I didn't know if they were throwing him under the bus or me, because neither one of us had really done much of this sort of thing. But it went really well. I was sorry we didn't get to meet with the fifth. I think it's very important. I agree. We did have a few people that were involved this year via Zoom that were not before. But I do think it's important for those of us, especially if you cannot travel for some reason, you're not unable to go to DC, it's super important to participate via Zoom. And we only had three on our team, and I think everybody would be better if we had like four or five team members. So I'm really encouraging everybody next year, please get on board, because not only is it good, it's good citizenship, being involved, but it's a whole lot of fun. and you get to meet nice people. So I really encourage everybody to participate. Thank you, and I apologize I was late.
It's okay. I just didn't think you were here. And I want to say about Mary that she was our secretary extraordinary. She took notes on, because I said, you know, I was kind of moderating meetings and trying to answer questions and parse out people and do all this stuff. And so I want to thank her. And the other thing I want to say before we move to the second aspect of our program is we will be writing a paper to submit to our president to bring before the executive committee. It is not orders, it's not commands, it's recommendations. And the heart of our recommendation will be this, that it is best to send people to D.C., but there are people with whom we cannot meet for whatever reason. So we should have a Zoom leader and people prepared to go to Zoom meetings, and every person that is the Washington, D.C. folks can't schedule a meeting with, will then be contacted by that person. And even if we don't get this done in time to send it to ACB in our feedback reports, at least we will have met with them. So that's my recommendation. And we met after everybody had done what they did, and everybody seemed to think that. So we will, well, people will be returning to D.C. next year to represent the Florida Council of the Blind, but we are going to have a Zoom voice as well. And hopefully we will meet with everybody, and we will send out our documentation and do all the things that we can. And I am just so looking forward to seeing what the next generation of legislative leaders are going to do with their new chair of governmental affairs. So this is all good. Now, the second part of our program. Anna, our dear friend, was scheduled to speak in this section, but because of her schedule, we just did what we did. So I now have before you to speak our dear friend and officer liaison, Connie Sims, our wonderful past president, Paul Edwards, and one of my most favoritist people, because he kind of is a troublemaker like me, is an attorney and a wonderful advocate who has such a heart for people, who is meeting with us today via Zoom, like Anna did, and so Mark Reichert. So what I'm going to do is, because Connie is our very special guest, we'll ask her to speak first, and then we will ask Mark to chime in, and then we will end with our own dear Mr. Edwards, who, as I've said, speaks off the cuff better than most people write. No. Well, you have to. All right. We're going to have Mark go first, because I really have a reason for wanting Paul to go last. You go in the middle. Okay, Mr. Reichert, you're on.
Wow. How about that? Fine. It's a good thing that I resisted the impulse to get up and pour myself another cup of iced tea and stay on mute when I first heard that Connie was going to go first. I thought, you know, good time for a break. But nope. And that's fine. So, hey, everybody. And I really hope that Anna wins, because honestly, I've flown through that Orlando airport so many times. I'm sick of hearing Buddy Dyer's voice, man. I mean, and especially because they seem to play it every 30 seconds or so over there. It's not like once an hour or something a little bit more reasonable. So this is not a political statement on my part. I'm just saying, man, I'm looking forward to hearing a different voice come through there, which is another way of saying that I originally grew up in Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, actually. Born at Holy Cross Hospital, 1969. And I moved away to come up here in the Washington area to go to law school. And ever since then, I've worked for a number of organizations, most extensively with the American Foundation for the Blind, doing their government affairs work as their director of public policy there. And I currently spend my I don't want to say my 9 to 5, because much of the work that I'm doing is in the middle of the night, believe it or not, as the head of international programs for the Overbrook School for the Blind. Yep, it's one of the oldest and most treasured of the schools for the blind in the country. But they have this vast international program called Mark Reichert, literally an army of one. And that's a blessing and a curse in a lot of ways. But it's a lot of fun because it means I get to meet colleagues from all over the world, in particular in Southeast Asia, where we are supporting non-governmental organizations, so essentially nonprofits, that really focus on the educational and technology needs of children and youth who are blind or have low vision. And we're trying to expand that type of activity into sub-Saharan Africa, which, as you can, I'm sure, imagine if you don't know already, is facing a lot of poverty, for sure. And you know, more often those blind kids, if they're getting any kind of education at all, they're getting it from, this is a fictitious figure, but I think you'll appreciate the iconography or whatever of it, is you know, Sister Mary Mambutu, who's, you know, 92 years old and has been doing an amazing job, such as he's able to do it, but is not really a professional educator in any way that any of us would recognize. I say all that, Debbie, as an introduction from my point of view, to say the thing that has struck me so much in doing this international work now for more than, I guess it's about 4.5 years, is that having come from a much longer background in the public policy space, so advocacy work in the United States, you might think, oh gosh, these folks overseas, and particularly the kiddos overseas, are facing dramatically different types of issues than our students in the U.S. face. And to be sure, the amount of resources that are available for them, I mean, it's just minuscule in comparison to what we invest in this country. But I would submit that it's all relative, ladies and gentlemen. And I remember in particular a 3.5-hour meeting with some folks in Vietnam. It was our partners there, but then also some folks from their Ministry of Education, and on and on. There are about 13, 14 of them sitting around the table. And I do not speak Vietnamese, don't speak French, don't speak Burmese. But so it was a little frustrating for me as I'm sitting there for this long meeting, and I'm barely understanding what people are saying as they try to speak in articulate, but nevertheless hard to understand English sometimes. And my foot's tapping and whatever for the first hour. And then it finally, you know, sometimes it takes forever to things sink into my head. And all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, all of these people are saying exactly the same things that we are saying, sure, on a different resource scale. But, you know, you'd get questions like, well, gee, we're not really sure how many blind kids there really are here in Vietnam. And we don't know nearly enough about their conditions, although we know that they have, most of them have other disabilities. And gee, the Ministry of Education just changed their, switched over to new textbooks, which means all of the textbooks such as we might have them in Braille or otherwise are, you know, obsolete. We can't use them now. So now we've got this shortage of people who know how to use the technology to produce the materials in formats that kiddos can read, and on it went like that. And it's true for adult services as well. This is my long way of getting around to my punchline, which is we've got more friends than we may know, and our issues, no matter where you are around the world, are all really fundamentally the same. And that was a profound revelation to me. And not only are they all the same, but also the techniques, the things that will actually make things change, the things that will make systems turn in a different direction, all of those things are the same as well in a lot of ways. And even in countries that don't really have a strong democratic, you know, small d, democratic tradition, it's the involvement of advocates who are determined not to just work for, you know, this month or this day, or to do one visit with a policymaker or an influencer of some kind, but who stick to it day in and day out, and much more appropriately, year in and year out, or even decade in and out. Because anything that we do in the policy space takes forever. It's the issue is never over. There's no such thing in the policy space. Even when you win spectacularly, even after you win, there's the implementation, there's the follow through, there's the inevitable inertia that comes with trying to change a system. And just because you change a law doesn't mean that it, and a lot of you know this already. My sermon then, Debbie, is just to say at this point, before maybe we have time for questions or we can talk amongst ourselves later, whatever you want to do, I would just say we welcome anyone who will spend any amount of time giving to the process of either visiting in person, writing, calling, showing up at a rally, whatever. If all you can do is a one-time flash in the pan thing, not telling you that we don't appreciate it, because everyone is appreciated. Time is precious. People have a lot of other obligations, especially all of us who are getting older and have to look out for older relatives or our spouses or kiddos or whatever other things we're involved in. We take what we can get from you. But I will say that organizationally, it is key. And it sounds, Debbie, like you all have definitely done this. So let's pour some hot sauce on it and make it even spicier as we move forward. But the reality of it is, if you're going to have any hope in actually making something change, one needs to institutionalize, almost discipline yourselves into committing to something for the long haul. Because by definition, policy changes, systems change, moving an aircraft carrier takes a lot of effort, and it is a commitment of time and financial resources. And it works. This will be my parting shot then, Debbie. It all works. If anybody feels like, gosh, there's no point, things are so divided, nobody's talking to each other, I don't know why I should bother. I mean, there's merit to those points. I mean, no one, you can't turn on a television or whatever, be it all out from under whatever rock you may be under, and not pick up on the fact that there is a sort of futility to a lot of it. But you know, there's one way to make sure that that futility and that standoff posture that it seems like we are so often in, there's one way to ensure that that stays that way, and that's by not getting involved. And if the choice is to get involved, again, if it's not you doing it all the time, but your organization should, and clearly FCB is heading in that direction, I'm certain that the most passionate advocates, Debbie being, you know, first among equals there, knows this already. It is a commitment not to this month, this year, but to do it, period, and to always be in the posture of being involved. And the final three or four sentences, Deb, I will say, are, if anybody thinks that one person can't make a difference, then I would tell you to reevaluate your assessment. Because I've seen it over and over again, where my favorite story here is years ago when we were trying to get accessible textbooks, and you would think, oh, textbooks for blind kiddos, who could possibly be opposed to that? They weren't necessarily opposed to it. It's just that it's inertia to try to get anybody to move, recognize the priority of it. I think someone reported earlier, a few moments ago, that their experience was exactly that with the legislative office, where they essentially said, gosh, we're surprised that these things haven't been done before. That's right. That's usually the response that we get. Nobody says, no, I think blind kids don't need textbooks on time. I mean, they're handicapped after all. And we have too much to do and not enough money. I mean, we have to make priorities. No one's going to say that, even if a few might think it. They're always going to express general support. The real question is, can you move them off the dime and get them to change? And we could not get anybody to move until one day a parent came down, met with one of the crustiest, most cantankerous staffers on Capitol Hill in Washington. And it was just one mom to another. And this mom was talking about how she was up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to help this kiddo read through materials. And this poor mom just, you know, well, she didn't intend to come there and cry. And she was terribly embarrassed, but she just totally cracked. And you could just hear the exhaustion in her voice. This is no professional slick advocate. I think, frankly, she only made a few visits with us and then kind of faded away. But that crusty Hill staffer, also being a mom who was exhausted, similarly started to cry. And those two ladies bonded, and it completely turned everything around. So don't ever think that your time and sometimes even your tears don't have an impact, because frankly, it's one of the only few things that does make an impact. With that, Deb, I'm going back on mute, but I appreciate you including me in this discussion.
I appreciate you doing it. You know why I did? Because of the kiddos. I've shed tears over these kiddos. And what I want to say about people making a difference, you don't have to be a big kahuna, but sometimes a parent or a grandparent or a guardian would call when we had an active task force for special education for our kiddos, as Mark calls them, and you would give them hope. You didn't give them legal advice. You didn't attend a meeting with them. You told them what their rights were. You gave them stuff that everybody would know. And they had, I can go to this meeting. I can say that my child, I can, and there's nothing like it. And I'm certainly not an expert on much of anything. I know a little bit about a lot, but what I know is it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. So that's the main reason I invited Mr. Reichert. So having said all of that, we're now going to go to the effervescent Miss Connie Sims and hear what she has to say.
Thanks, Debbie. So thank you for having me. So I am actually the board liaison, as Debbie said. I am actually from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So this is my second time in a month I've been to Orlando. So yeah, I've been traveling a lot this last month. This is my third trip, so in a month. I'm not sure what I all want to share. And you want me special stuff. So my folks told me when I was like a sixth grader, basically, you need to learn how to stand up for yourself. I was, you know, when you're a kid, you learn things. And I was going to public school at the time, and I actually graduated. I'm sorry. I just feel like the room next door is really loud. that, you know, I ended up graduating from the South Dakota School for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and actually the Groton School where I grew up in a small town. So I have two high school diplomas, graduated a week apart from both of them. But my folks told me, you know, you need to learn how to stand up for yourself. My folks were really strong advocates. And we lived in a small town, and I never forgot those words that she told me when I was a sixth grader, when I was 12, 13 years old. I never forgot how passionate and how much they fought for me. So when I advocate, I don't advocate just for myself, but I advocate for everyone, you know, like everyone else does, like Mark was talking. I not just for the blind and low vision, but I talk about, you know, the elderly. I talk about other disabilities. I had an uncle that was mentally disabled. I have cousins and stuff that were in wheelchairs. I have a great nephew that's Down syndrome. I have a friend that's kind of a Down syndrome, nonverbal. So I think of all of these people that how does everything affect them? So when I advocate, I think about everyone. My husband is totally blind and hearing impaired. So I have low vision. So I think about him and just hearing impaired. So I've always done a lot of local stuff. I'm sorry, just getting distracted over there. I'm sorry, but can we ask them to tone it down or something?
No.
No? Okay. Because it's just like echoing in my ear. I belong to a lot of local stuff.
Stand up and go behind
Okay. You might help. Yes, I could right in my back here. Okay. All right, I must change positions here. So on the local level, I belong to like the Active Transportation Board in Sioux Falls. I have been appointed. So I really advocate, you know, we're talking about technology next door, which is great, but I think of other things. I think about the built environment. a lot of times. And we don't think about that a lot of times, I don't think, as individuals. But the built environment has to do with, you know, sidewalks. It has to do with, you know, public transit. It has to do with stairs, lighting. You know, how do we get around someone as we're blind or low vision? How do we get around safely and independently? We want to be just like everyone else. So going back to the local, I do a lot. I have a lot of relationships with my city government. And it's taken years. It's taken years to work with the planners, the engineers. But now they really respect me. And they actually listen when I speak up. And my board that I'm on, I'm the only one that's disabled. But when I'm not on the meeting for some reason, they actually ask questions. How is this going to affect someone who is visually impaired or blind? And that means a lot to me because I've educated them enough to how important that is to be included. And they have really started making improvements locally in the city that has improved, you know, the sidewalks, the transit, all of that type of stuff. So that is important. On the state level, I've done a lot of different things. Mark has been involved with a little bit with that. We had a superintendent for our school for the blind and visually impaired that kind of ran it down into the ground. He needed to go. We worked, state, of course, backed him and protected him and stuff. But I led an advocacy group with the teachers and some parents, and we actually got him out. But it took a lot of work. But it took everyone speaking up and doing stuff and guidelines, you know. Mark was a great, you know, resource. We had some other national people that talked. But it's just reaching out to the people that you need to know, that you can figure out, that you can support with you with. I've done other stuff on the state level. I've been a lot of legislative stuff. Years ago, we were talking about changing some stuff on it had to do with the print on some petitions, and it had to do with some voting and all of that type of stuff. And I was going speaking. I was virtual during our legislative session, and you know, I had to listen to all these homeschool kids and the families. And don't get me wrong, I love them. I have a lot of family that are teachers and stuff, and I have friends that are homeschoolers, but they wanted some rights. They wanted some things changed. And the legislators listened to them. I mean, they had testimony for 3 hours. And it got to our stuff. And I have a friend that's a legislator. So he had actually shared stuff that I needed to talk about and share and what would really get to the legislators. And our state motto is, under God, the people rule. So I brought that up when I testified, and I said, you know, so the school kids matter to you, but people who are disabled don't mean anything to you. And I was blunt. I always, as Debbie can tell you, or Sheila, or, you know, I'm pretty blunt on my stuff. So they're like, well, you know, they didn't know what to say, and I kind of went on, and I talked about some personal stories, not just myself, but others. And, you know, I said, you know, you need to think about this. And I don't remember the whole saying, but I ended with, you know, the people, under God, the people rule. And I said, you know, we are the people. Even though we're disabled, we are part of this people. And we are voters, and we vote you in or vote you out. So you need to think about that. And I don't remember how it ended, how I specifically said my speech, but it was dead silent, absolutely dead silent. Come to find out, the assistant director for our services of the blind and visually impaired was in the room. I didn't know that until the next day. And I got reached out by the director at the time and said, wow, you kind of quieted, shut up everyone for on your speech. And I'm like, oh, yeah? Well, the attorney, or our vice, our governor, not the governor, but the lieutenant governor, thank you. Lieutenant governor was there. And he was impressed and how I had really hit everyone. So the next time we had legislation, we actually got everything passed. They listened to us and stuff. But it was a matter of me being some blunt and sharing the stories and calling them out. And I hate to say that, but I kind of did. So then this year, Debbie knows the story, but they were going to take away the voting machines for South Dakota. There was huge proponents to take away the voting machines and go back to hand counting all the precincts in South Dakota. So I ended up being the only low vision blind person speaking. And so we, Cole Euchre, who is our disability rights representative, he spoke ahead of me, and we had some other auditors and stuff that spoke in favor for us, but it was like a two-part bill, and they kept saying it wasn't fair, it wasn't safe, all of this good stuff. So Cole had spoke about, he got down to our security at the Capitol on break, and he had said, how many wheelchairs do we have? He had five, and he's like, how often do they get used? And they said, hardly ever, except at Christmas, because we have Christmas at the Capitol. We have trees from Thanksgiving or before Thanksgiving to after New Year's. And he said, then we don't have enough. They're always used. So he used that example when he testified, and he said, so we don't hardly ever use these, but yet we need them. And they get used all the time at a certain time of the year. He said, what if someone wanted to, we didn't have the wheelchairs right now. He said, what if someone who wanted to testify came to testify and you couldn't get up here? He said, are you going to make one of your pages or your staff members carry them up? He said, I'm sure you're not going to do that. But he said, that's what would happen, because he said, it's not fair. So that kind of hit them. And I got on and I spoke and I talked about how, you know, again, we want to be independent. And I talked about how when I first started voting, that was before the ADA, and I live in a small town. And my mom wanted to help me vote for the very first time when I was 18. And our city auditor refused, because it wasn't independent, and she couldn't help me, and it was supposed to be, you know, private. So we ended up having to go in to our county seat, 18 miles away, to vote. And I shared that story about how they would let me, my mom helped me vote, but to see the ballot, but otherwise they wouldn't let me, because it's one person, one vote, right? And it's independent and it's private. So we talked about that, and I shared those stories, and I shared some other stories about myself and some other people. And we actually, we won. We won. They asked the proponents to separate it and still do the hand counting, but keep the electric auto marks for all the blind and low vision disability people, and they refused. So the legislators actually killed the bill. They sent it to the 43rd day, and they actually killed the bill. So that way it couldn't go anywhere else. And it was because, like Cole said, it was because of what I shared my testimony in the personal, and they all admitted that. They realized how important the real life experiences are. So on the national level, being on the ACB board, I do a lot of advocacy work, and I've said this is my third time in a month. So I was here in Orlando, first part of April, and it was a huge, not convention, but it was called the ISA, which it stands for the International Sign Association Expo. It's the largest in the world, and I mean, we had people from Peru, we had South America, we, you know, South Korea, we had them all over. And I was asked to come and present at the pre-conference in a boot camp, and it was something new for them. But we had signed, Pat Sheehan, some of you guys may know and may not know, but he's a past board member for ACB, and he worked in the government affairs for the VA, and he was a representative for what we call the ANSI, the American National Institute of, basically it's codes for all the disabled. So our joke is that we spend every 2 weeks for 4 hours a day on a Thursday going over everything that you ever want to know about disabilities, from bathroom stalls to urinals to how they're positioned to hand dryers to ramps to stairs, everything. So I know more about bathrooms than I probably ever want to know about. So it's like adult changing, you can talk about it. I know about it now. So so it's he we got signed contracts passed this year, and it's the first time in 30 years. ACB is the only blind association that is on this committee. And because of that, I got pulled into what's called the IBC, the International Building Code. So we have the ADA, and then we have the ANSI, and then we have the IBC. IBC and the ANSI are kind of the same thing, but under the same organization. But wrapping it up so Paul has time, but it's basically we got lighting passed, we got sign contrast passed, and we actually did a boot camp at the ISA Expo. For owners, for designers, for engineers, and I did a presentation, and then I had three designers that helped do a boot camp with simulations with all different types of low vision, and we had them do blindfolded, and they said we had like 40 members, and it was wonderful because they really appreciated everything, but it was a life experiences that taught them, and they said it was the best thing that they've ever had. It was a continuing ed. So then in IBC this 2 weeks ago, I testified, and we had passed stair striping in the IBC a couple of years ago, the International Building Code, and we passed that in the other committee also, but then we had to defend it with the members. And the thing is that the members overturned the committee. But at the end that we testified and we lost, but it was a win in the end. And I worked with a lot of researchers, a lot of engineers, very well-known people throughout the country. So they could give one of the top optometrists that knows contrast and all that good stuff. But then I presented personal stuff, and I shared not just my stuff, but other people's. I used different examples of what everyone sees and shares. But at the end, I talked about how the built environment is built for them and how I never had 20/20 vision. And you want to tell me how to see, but you've never had my vision. So I kind of turned tables on them. And at the very end, the room again was dead silent. Pat Sheehan was listening live online, and he said you could just hear it go silent. in the background. And again, they admitted afterwards that we failed, but now starting in June, they want to reintroduce it with the correct language, and they realize how important all of this is and reintroduce another code. So again, the personal stories, the connections that you can make, it can take years, it can take months, it can take little time, but standing up for yourself and believing in yourself and sharing your story or someone else's story is what really gets to people.
Thank you, Connie.
So thank you. That's what I wanted to say. So thanks.
All right, we're going to hear in closing a few words from Paul Edwards, and I just want to thank all of you for.
Do we have time?
Yes, we do. Let's just do it.
It's still 2:30.
It's let's just do it.
Is it okay?
It's not quite 2:30 yet. So thanks to everyone for being here. Thanks for all the work, and please take some of these thoughts with you. And it isn't important. You don't have to be like everybody else. Nobody's asking you to be Connie Sims. They're asking you to be you. So we're going to end this with our dear friend and one of the best mentors I ever had, Paul Edwards.
Cockroaches survive everywhere. It's amazing. No matter what we do to get rid of them, no matter what efforts we make to eradicate them, they survive. It's amazing. Some of them are huge, but the ones that are hardest to get rid of are the little tiny ones. And they seem to be everywhere, those cockroaches. I invite all of you to be cockroaches. And I invite you to be cockroaches because they have the capacity to survive no matter what environment they're in. The environment that we're in at the moment suggests that for blind and visually impaired people, there is not a lot of opportunity for us to be successful, but like the cockroach, we will persevere. It's absolutely crucial to understand that what we are doing at the moment is demonstrating insectile capacity. And it's also important for us to recognize that what we have done in Florida over the past 3 or 4 years it has demonstrated precisely that. For a long time, even though we were little tiny cockroaches lurking at the edge of the consciousness of legislators, the reality was they didn't know we were there. So for the past 3 years, we have stuck our little feelers out and visited legislative offices in Tallahassee with an effort to demonstrate to them that people who are blind are persistent and will not go away. And the issues that us cockroaches have are issues that, whether they like it or not, are going to be issues that they are going to know about. Our job, ladies and gentlemen, is to operate as cockroaches, and no matter what legislators say, no matter what individual public officials say, we are going to survive, hang around, and share all of the issues that we have. In an environment that is uncomfortable for us now, what we need to do is to demonstrate who we are. Cockroaches are very proud creatures. And that is why it's important for us to recognize that we will not only survive, but we will thrive by being who we are. We are people who are blind. We are people with issues that are ours. We are people with issues that don't change and that have not been ameliorated no matter what. It is absolutely crucial, ladies and gentlemen, that we recognize that we are the only people who can speak for ourselves. And I urge all of you to join me as cockroaches.
Let's keep advocating.